on it, and it's just, yeah.
This will so be a
challenge. Interesting. We'll see how nice it looks.
Okay.
Not very nice.
Okay, so welcome back, everybody. We're going to resume. So I have the pleasure to introduce Dr. Jonathan Lichtenstein. Okay, ladies. Dr. Lichtenstein is Director of Pediatric Neuropsychological Services at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth and Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. Ladies, please. Thank you. He oversees the outpatient service and multidisciplinary clinics. Dr. Lichtenstein also serves as a consultant to concussion management programs at high schools and colleges in New Hampshire and is the team neuropsychologist for Dartmouth College Athletics. He's the co-director of Concussion Chalk Talk, a grant-funded school-based concussion management program, which places an emphasis on returning to learn. Dr. Lichtenstein completed fellowships in clinical neuropsychology at the Geisel School of Medicine and Sports Concussion Center of New Jersey. He earned his doctorate in clinical psychology and an MBA at Widener University. And many of you know Dr. William Storrow, who spoke with us, I think, last year even. They're well-known colleagues to each other.
So, yes.
Just one caveat. Our computer system's really slow today, so be patient with the PowerPoint if it's not doing what we'd like. Okay.
Okay, Mike, how's the mic? Check one, check two, we're okay? Thanks for having me. I recognize some of the faces here. Hi, Ellen, I see you there. If I've spoken to any of you guys before, I apologize if we get some redundancy here. And I'm sorry also if you've been exposed to this topic multiple times. It's pretty hot right now. Everybody's wants to talk about it. And, you know, if you've seen Bill Storrow talk, we do it a little bit differently, but I think some of the key messages are pretty much the same. But the first thing I do want to know, and after, you know, I got to see the last about 15 minutes, Dr. Kim speaking, and seeing the exchange is really the key part for me, because you guys are in the school dealing with the issues day to day, all the challenges that I'll talk about. I don't have the answers for them, unfortunately. I'll just talk about the problems. But who's frustrated by this issue of concussion and returning to learn, especially? Yeah. I'm definitely frustrated with it too, and you know, Joan mentioned this program that we're doing, and it's a grant-funded program to look at how you implement a return-to-learn plan. That's the stage we're really in scientifically, is trying to understand from an evidence base how do we even make it function as a streamlined process, not just what's the best evidence-based solution. It's how do we actually make it a functional thing. And so that's still where we are. We're still in that infancy point of trying to make it a systematic program that really works well. So I'm with you on the frustration. I want to hear from you guys today, so I will try to rush through a lot of this stuff so that we can talk about it. And also I encourage you, after we're done, if you have more questions, if you have things to offer me that I know I can learn from you guys, please contact me. Let's talk more about it, okay? I'm required to make a disclosure, which is that I'm a medical advisor for a company called the Brain Trust, which is a startup. We're interested in how we better educate schools about concussion. That's what it does, okay? The other disclosure I have to make is that this is really hard work, and that we're all learning through the experiences that we accrue by facing these challenges, by trying to work with these kids, and you guys are doing it every day, and we're trying to learn, let's see if this works, sort of, from what you guys get. And that's the same thing with me. Every time I talk to a parent, every time I meet with a child who's gone through a complicated recovery, and I hear about what the stages were and maybe where things slipped up, I'm learning more and more about this process of return to learn. So in brief, just quickly, we'll talk for a second. So about definition. So a concussion is a brain injury. Do we have that one? Everybody's got that, right? Okay, I think that's probably been hammered into everyone's head too. So, you know, brain injury occurs on a spectrum that Carl talked about as mild, moderate, and severe. And a concussion is in most circles considered a mild traumatic brain injury. There will be some people that tell you that a concussion is not a brain injury, but I'm going to be one of those people who tells you that it is one. The other, a more complicated definition is that it's a complex pathophysiological process caused by biomechanical forces. My jaw hurts just when I say that, okay? And there's, you know, something, I saw a presentation years ago, something like 43 definitions exist for the term concussion in the medical literature. It's a complicated thing to pin down, and we're still trying to learn what it really is from an underlying neurobiological standpoint. It's still emerging. But basically, there's something going wrong in the physiology, pathophysiology, and it's caused by some external force to the body, to the head. And this might be, this is a nice little gif about what might be happening when the skull is contacted with. Wow, this is so slow. I guarantee you, this is a beautiful graphic. But it's not working. You'll have to take my word for it. Essentially, you know, the brain is this soft, compressible tissue, and it's not affixed to the skull. It's not really floating either. It's attached to the stem, but it's in the head and inside the skull, and when there's a big force, enough of a force, it moves around, right? So it shakes, and like I said, it's compressible tissue, so things inside it, like a kind of like a spongy sort of feel, they move, and that movement, underlying that movement, is where the injury is happening. Now, it can happen where the inside the skull, it's these bony parts, and the brain can bump up against one side, it can bump up against another, it can bump on the sides, but it can also be about the rotation of the brain inside the skull. So it's sitting like that, right? So it could go forwards and backwards, could go side to side, but it can also twist like this. And that can also have an impact on the functioning, on the underlying structure. And so here's a funny little cartoon graphic of maybe what's going on at the level of the cell in this injury, okay? And we don't need to understand all these pieces. I try to forget them as soon as I learn them. But the point is that around the cell body, in the intra and extracellular space, all those neurotransmitters that are in there nicely aligned in a good chemical balance get thrown out of balance. So the ones that should be in the cell leave the cell, the ones that shouldn't be in the cell come into the cell. This disruption causes an impairment in the communication from neuron to neuron, okay? And so if this is all chaotic, then to get across into the next cell makes it very complicated, and there's a disruption in this. And then we tend to see a functional change in our day-to-day life. I'll come back. You'll see this graphic again when I talk about maybe more of the real utility. Another element of the injury underlying things is what they call a diffuse axonal injury. So it's a damage to the axon, so here's our cell body, and then the axon down goes to the dendrites to the next cell. And this is where that communication is running down this line, right? Down that axon. And we used to think or conceive of the axons actually maybe breaking in an injury, and that might be happening in a moderate or severe traumatic brain injury where the axons actually physically break. And then the brain has to do rehabilitation, and I'm sure a lot of you guys in this room know about this or have done it, to rebuild those connections. In concussion or mild TBI, we're thinking more about the rotation of the brain, as I was talking about before, and how that might lead to not tearing, but twisting of the axons, which is enough to cause a damage in the transmission of the signal. Okay, now we're talking about white matter. So white matter tracks in the brain, or what sort of connects, it's the pathways. So it connects all the different areas of the brain to allow for coordinated function and movement. You know, nothing that we do with the brain really is only localized in one region. That's how we like to think about it. It's how we teach sixth graders about the brain, is that you've got the frontal lobes for attention, and you've got the temporal lobe for language, and occipital for vision, parietal for visual spatial functioning. And that's nice, but the fact is that it's really about how those pieces connect, and that's really how it works. It's all about networks. And white matter tracks are what allow those networks to connect. And this is a sort of a composite of what's called diffusion tensor imaging, which looks at white matter tracks. And here's a brain that hasn't had a brain injury, and you can see all the fibers that are connecting the different areas of the brain. And then you look at a brain that's been under TBI, and you can see all these missing pieces. So when you look at people further down the road, what you see is these changes, that there's decreased white matter volumes, and that may be affecting all kinds of things about their cognition, about their emotional functioning, about their physiological response. And neural networks, as I said a second ago, are this other big piece. Networks are sort of groups of brain regions that are responsible for certain types of functions. And it's, once again, it's not about one particular area, but it's about how these areas speak to each other. And I'll just point your attention to this one network. So this is what's called resting state functional magnetic resonance imaging. And basically, the default mode network, the DMN, is a network in the brain that is active when we are at rest. So even when we're not doing anything, we're not trying to solve a problem, or I'm sorry, I'm blocking your view, or do a task, there's a big part of our brains that are still really active. And that's the default mode network. And in the default mode network, we see in people with traumatic brain injury or even mild traumatic brain injury that there are alterations in that in those connections. So even when the brain is at rest, something is amiss. And why am I talking about all these things that you'd only see in a research study and all this stuff? It's because most of the clinical imaging that's used, like CT or MRI, are not useful for the most part in concussion. They're there to rule out brain bleeds, but which is rare in mild traumatic brain injury, so that's only going to help one small percentage of the population. But most of mild TBI folks are not going to show anything on CT or MRI. It's going to look like a normal brain, but underneath it all, something is happening. So that's why I'm showing you all these pieces that are more research related. And okay, so now stepping into the real world. So the symptom pictures that we might see, right, tends to be grouped into these four domains of the physiological, where headache is kind of the main heavy hitter, cognitive, where we see the concentration and processing speed issues, emotionality, where irritability is a key one, but also these elements of sadness and nervousness. And then sleep is a huge issue, right, where you probably see it all the time in your kids now, who either they complain that they're having trouble initiating sleep or they can't stay asleep. Maybe at first they're sleeping too much, but then as you go on, they're not sleeping at all because they're so anxious. And I have these arrows here because they're all tied together. You know, to think about these things again on islands is just ridiculous. So, because when somebody's not sleeping well, that affects their concentration. If it affects their concentration, they might be worried about, why am I not concentrating so well, or why am I losing track of all this, and they might get pretty anxious about it. They might get anxious, and they might get a headache. They might get a headache, they might not go to sleep, and then they can't sleep. And it's just this cycle, right? And so we want to educate as best we can to help them understand that this is not just things on islands. This is a network of things, and if we try to address one, maybe we'll solve another. So that's part of why I brought this up. And you know, I think Dr. Carlson will talk a little more next about some of the other components of that physiological side related to balance and vestibular functioning and oculomotor functioning, which is also very key components. But this is sort of that larger piece that I think we tend to think about. So I often give a part of on this talk about managing a sports concussion, but I'm not going to do that because Dr. Carlson's going to do that next as part of her talk. She'll talk about lots of things in the school. So I'm going to play my Uno skip card on this one. Good, familiarity with Uno in the room. That's good. Okay, so here's our four symptom clusters. I think we'll end up thinking more today about the cognitive and emotional side. I'm not going to talk as much about the emotional side. I have a whole slide deck about the emotional response in concussion, but today we're really going to try to focus on this return to learn piece, which a lot of it I'm going to try to stick in the cognitive realm to try to give some concrete recommendations, some concrete ideas, things that you can maybe bring to teachers or just as a way to organize our thinking. Because I think a lot of times you guys will get notes from docs or from PCPs that'll just have sort of like everything checked on that ACE form or something that just says, you know, right, so do all these things. And they never give you a time of when to stop them or when to think about which ones would be appropriate. And I know from experience, that from feedback, that teachers are frustrated by this because they don't feel like they have any real direction. And I don't know if I'm going to be able to give you that direction today, but I'm going to try to, you know, organize it in some way for us so we can think about it. All right, so how does it work? No, I'm asking you, how does it work? So I'm, like I said before, still trying to figure all of it out. But that's part of it. You know, why are we even focused on it so much now? And I think part of it is that for so long we were focused on the physical piece. It was all about athletes with concussion, right? With good reason. They're at a higher risk because they're doing things that put them at risk for this. So we were always focused on what's the right thing to do right after the injury to make sure that they don't get a second injury, right? That's a huge piece. We want to avoid that catastrophic potential event. But also, what might be bad for their symptom recovery? What might you know, slow it down. And so we were always focused on don't go back to the physical activities too quickly. That's, of course, gone too far in the wrong direction. But we didn't really think a lot about what cognitive activities had, what effect that had on symptoms, and what that did to recovery. And so we know two things now from the research that's gone on, like the last 5 years, maybe less, is that doing mentally taxing activities right after the injury can make symptoms worse. That's one thing we know from research. Another thing we know from research is that it can prolong recovery, obviously, because if the symptoms get worse, then it takes longer for them to feel better, ultimately. So we have to think about this as a method for our intervention is reducing those cognitive tasks, at least at the onset, and dealing with them in a certain way. So here we are, back to our graphic. And one of the things I just want to call your attention to here is what this was made by Chris Giza, and the energy crisis is the key piece for what I want to talk about. With the disruption in the cellular chemistry, what the cells are not doing is producing the amount of neural energy or glucose that's going to allow the brain to meet all its demands. So the body is saying, I need the energy to do X, Y, and Z task. But right after a concussion, it's not actually producing enough of it to do it. So it's a supply and demand mismatch. Brain wants, you know, the body wants to do X tasks like study for that test, take that note, but the brain actually wants time to repair itself because the brain's pretty miraculous when it comes to that. It's this amazingly adaptable organ. It's what one of my colleagues calls the ultimate workaround, that the brain just figures out ways to get around the problems that it encounters. But if we put too much pressure on the system, it doesn't have the time to do that. So think of supply and demand. How do you want to use the limited resources that the brain has after injury? You want to use it for repair, or do you want to use it for the math test? Probably not the math test. I mean, I did terrible at math, so you know I don't value it as much. So and then think about school as this really demanding environment. So if we think about those first days and all the impetus that it puts on resources, those crowded hallways, the lunchroom with all of its stimuli and things to process, and how visual and how much sort of orientation there is in classrooms today to the video piece. And then just think about even the social undertones that are going on in schools, and that is a big piece that draws our attention and our resources. So it's pretty rough, I think, when we're first coming back. And then the classroom, of course, has its own demands. I've already mentioned things like note-taking and then all this computer work, the visual processing is very taxing on the system, incorporating all these pieces and all those multimodal aspects. So it would be really nice and simple if we could break return to learn down into really basic concrete steps. And I'll talk about how it's done. It's what people do and they try. Because it's all modeled off of return to play. How many people in this room are the people who at your school run the return to play protocols? Okay, yeah, so there's some number of us, right? So you're used to understanding this idea that we're trying to test the system with a physical challenge in a gradual way. So we first want to see the symptoms come down with no activity. But then as soon as they show that they don't have those symptoms, we start in with some light aerobic exercise, get the heart rate up a little bit, and then we test them for their symptom response. Do you have symptoms after this, Johnny? How do you feel? Here's a checklist. What are you endorsing? If they don't endorse anything, after 24 hours, they go to the next step. But it's all done in a gradual way. Thank you. Yeah. So as you can see, it gets more and more complicated. You go into sports specifics, which adds more movement. You go into the more of the non-contact practice related things that bring coordination and thinking into it, and then to that full contact practice before finally you get gameplay. Okay? This was all designed in the mode of getting athletes back to the field, right? But in a safe way. We're going to do it in a gradual way. We're going to test at each stage for the symptomatic response, and if we get that symptoms, we move back one. And we don't let them go forward. So ultimately, it could take a week to get back to the field if they show no symptoms right away. It might take longer depending on how they respond. So it would be nice if we could just put return to learn in that sort of concrete piece. The only the only objective finding there is the symptoms. What does the athlete say? And that's it. But I just don't see return to learn that level. It's more of like a complex recipe, right? You've got all these different ingredients, and you've got a fact that returning to academic performance is not just based on symptoms after a physical exercise. It's based on your symptoms and your response to different types of academic material as well. So you've got a student who maybe wasn't as strong at language arts beforehand. Now they get an injury that affects their attention and their concentration and their ability to learn and process information quickly, and that might be even harder for them to return. They might speed back in math for whatever reason because it comes naturally to them, but they're still struggling to get back. That reading assignment is just the most challenging thing for them now. They can't process that information. They get stuck, they get frustrated. And so if we're trying to measure this on us by steps, what do we do with that kid who's gotten through it back to their normal piece after on two classes, but on another two, they're still way behind? Do we say they can move forward? Do we say they can't move forward? I just think it's way more complicated than just saying, do they reach that step and then they pass it? And I'll talk a little about that in a second. I still, you know, we're trying new things to try to figure it out. And so there's many attempts at this, right? The CDC has their guidelines they've had out for a long time with return to learn steps. And they all make sense. Neil McGrath, a neuropsychologist in Massachusetts, who put out some really good ones. He wrote actually a great article about school nurses and their role in concussion management. If you have not seen that, I highly recommend it. It's a little touch outdated at this point, but it's from. But Neil McGrath is his name. I would definitely read that. And if I have the opportunity to send out that link through you guys, I can put that out there too. Tina Master is a doc at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia who put out a return to learn stepwise, and her contribution to this was adding in cognitive load, sort of saying, well, if they can do X amount of their homework percent, then you move forward without symptoms. So she was adding this idea of how can we better quantify this? But I got to tell you, seeing it in action, it's still not perfect, so it runs into lots of problems. Carol DiMatteo's group is in Canada, and they got a lot of money from the Canadian government to put these things together, both return to play, return to activity, return to school stuff. And it's great reading. It's awesome reading. It just doesn't, it's not evidence-based, and it's still hard to follow. Karen McAvoy's group, the REAP program, which is in Colorado, so much information there. I'm just recommending, this is stuff that's just good to read. It's good to be informed on it. The Halsted group put out this. This is what the American Academy of Pediatrics follows. So if you ever saw Bill Storrow talk on this, he probably went in detail on that statement. And the Oregon Center for Applied Science also has a really nice write-up and different recommendations for this. And then, of course, if this graphic stuff was working more fluidly and this wasn't a really old computer system, you would have seen that concussion chalk talk fly in, which is our program. So that's this grant-funded program in the state of New Hampshire, and we've tried to make our own based on what we think might be the best. The point is all these are not evidence-based, so I can't come to you and say, this is the one to do, these are the way to do it. The return to play guidelines, everybody agrees on. It's international guidelines. Everyone buys into that. But with these, it's all about preference because none of them are really right on. I don't expect you to read all this, but we've just put it into colors. That's one of our contributions, okay? You're on red, you're on orange, you're on yellow, you're on green. Everybody understands the traffic light sort of Sesame Street language. And what we really try to do is include lots of pieces from all these different return to learn stages. So we try to get work in there. How much work are they really expected to do? Is it a 50% workload? Is it that they don't do work and they just sort of listen and they sit and they try to comprehend the material without really having to do much output? Is it based on what adjustments happen? And I'm talking about adjustments, not accommodations. So when we get into accommodation, we're talking about 504 language. I'm just talking about adjustments, the things that teachers do for their kids every day in a classroom that doesn't require some legal document. How long they might expect to stay in a particular stage, it's going to vary widely, right? Every kid, some come in and they've got no symptoms, they're ready to go pretty much right away. We probably want to still hold them back a little bit, but they want to go full steam because they feel fine, and they may be fine on testing too. And other people just take a lot longer based on certain predictive factors. How do you move to a next stage? And then what we tried to add was more data. So how do we get more information from the different players? How do we ask the teachers, what are you seeing in the classroom? What adjustments were actually implemented? What was used? This is a way to actually give us a metric to say, okay, X amount was used in that day, so they probably shouldn't be moving on. Or they didn't use any that day. Well, so that makes sense. Maybe they're ready to move forward. We just needed to get more input from people because it's not enough just to have that PCP's note that says, do all of these things. Right? So we're trying. We're working through this right now in the schools. And when I wave to Ellen, it's because we're talking with her school about maybe working with her. So So this is just another one. I just wanted to show you guys that. So it's not about steps for me. It's about guidelines. It's about principles. And a lot of this comes right out of a lot of that work that I was alluding to before, all those people who have put out their guidelines and their steps. And I think it's about the principles. Developing something that's individualized is so key, and I think this is where the school nurses play that major role, which is you guys probably have a sense of the child. You might know them from before. You have a way of knowing so much about the school, and you're that medical provider at the school. You can help develop the specific plan that's going to meet their needs, because to have something that's cookie cutter just doesn't seem to cut it. All right, so we'll get back to that slide about the guiding principles. I'm going to keep trying to come back to it as an orienter for us. But let's just quickly delve into cognitive rest for a second. So we talked about how in those initial phases, we want to make sure that while the brain is still trying to get its repair in, we want to do the right thing right away, not put them through too much taxing activity right away. So concussion management is about rest. That's sort of the common sense choice, is to rest the brain in the initial stages. And we thought that was really the best thing. And we thought, well, why don't we, initially people were resting people for, a week just as a blanket, sort of just saying, just do that and keep them out of activity for this amount of time. But we've learned that's not really maybe the best thing to do. I'll talk about that in a second. So what does it really mean? It just means a reduction in mentally taxing activities, such as, if we think about in a school environment, it would be things like those longer reading assignments, equations, things that involve problem solving. Taking a test, which means that the student has to dig back into their long-term memory or their short-term memory if they just crammed for the test right beforehand and have to pull that information out. The research paper where you're having to integrate different pieces of info from different sources can be challenging. Additionally, other pieces in school, anything with rapid visual scanning, the lunchroom, as we talked about before, band, where just the loud noises may be very aggravating for the system to process. All this computer work, so much is going on in smart boards and computers now, that's sort of the ubiquity in the school setting, but we want to try to reduce it if we can. And then note-taking, of course, major cognitive process. We talked before about this period of vulnerability, the mismatch in the brain's demand for glucose and what it actually produces in the blood. This is back to that graphic about the supply and demand issue. So we're trying to really do something in the early stages. Now, this is an old graphic, which was sort of thinking about this in a three-day marker. And what you can't see here at the bottom is actually cerebral blood flow, which in children seems to take much longer to normalize than in adults. Some studies show as much as 6-7 weeks, there's still an altered cerebral blood flow volume, which may then impact how much oxygen the brain is really getting and how that glucose is being distributed. So in kids, it may just take longer to get normal. So we want to be pretty vigilant to the early stages especially. But my problem is that rest has gone from that initial time to now being, and just to those things that are really mentally taxing, and now it's been sort of extended well beyond it, right? So to the point where even where docs are keeping kids out of school for extended periods of time when nobody's really paying attention to their symptomatic response. So to just say no school for a week or for 2 weeks doesn't really make a lot of sense if they're actually seemingly like they're back to normal. Pulling them from social activities, that can be a terrible experience for a teenager. Just imagine to be deprived of the thing that means the most to you in life. All physical activity seems to also be restricted, but physical activity is terrific for cognition, for feeling better physically, for emotional status, and obviously you want to not do it too much and it should be under supervision, but to the point of restricting it completely, unfortunately I see a lot of kids in the clinic that are a year and a half out, 2 years out, and then you look at what's happened and it's because so many things that have been done where they've been pulled from all manner of sort of fulfilling activities and for both their health and their emotional well-being. So, and even I've seen some docs say don't use the telephone. So, I don't know, I think it's interesting. One of the recommendations I actually give for acute management is call a grandparent. So if you got nothing to do, you got to think about what we can do to make these kids more entertained. Call your grandparent and ask them to tell you a story. Talk about how things were. Call a relative and find out something interesting that you never known before. You're sitting around for 2 days, you got nothing to do. If you got to figure out something to do. So I think calling someone on the phone is fine. Anyway. But it gets to a point where, you know, these folks, these kids seem to be like they're put in a cooler, or you've heard the term cocoon therapy, which is that idea of being sent home to be in a dark room for 7 days or so. I mean, that looks awful, right? So I just don't see the benefit of restricting all stimulation. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Especially when we talk about, and Dr. Carlson talked about this too, I mean, this is an injury that in most cases gets better on its own really quickly. It's only 15% or so that take longer than a month or 2 months, depends on your age, that you want to look at, to get better. So most kids are going to get better in a pretty short span of time. But since we're still figuring this all out, I think people throw the same generic things at people. And if we do the things that are too far in the wrong direction, we could do some damage. And so if you're home, so this is just, it's boring to do nothing. And so kids don't comply with it. And this goes all the way up in college and in adults too. You treat adults with this and you try to get them to slow down and it's just impossible. But so kids often do the wrong stuff. They play a lot of video games, they eat junk food. So let me just point to one study that was done, a randomized control trial that had two groups, one that rested for just 1 or 2 days before beginning sort of a stepwise activity back to life, which included going to school, and then a group that rested strictly for 5 days. So they did all those things where we said before about what is rest and pulling all these things away. And then they did some measures day 3 and day 10. What they found was that the group that did the strict rest actually had a longer symptom duration. The kids who were sent back into life after 2 days, they began to show symptom improvement pretty quickly and just a higher total number, and also more emotional symptoms, which makes sense if you think about all the things that we were talking about before in terms of restriction. I do wish this was clicking quicker. But so it's really key to rest well in those first 2 days. But afterwards, we have to be a little more vigilant to what we're doing. We have to really look at the symptom response and say, would it make more sense to rest more, or are we ready to move forward? So here are some of these takeaways from this article about how if you're not in school and you're just home focusing on yourself and on your symptoms, that's all you're going to think about. You're just going to process over and over again, how do I feel? How bad do I feel? I was told to pay attention to how I feel. And then, oh, God, I must have a headache. Or, wow, yeah, I did just step. I got off the couch and I did move a little bit to the left. I must have a balance problem. But if they're in school just going through their normal routine, I think that's not what they're going to focus in on. I think they're going to be more focused on these other stuff that's around them. And if that causes symptoms, okay, then we know that wasn't the threshold for them, right? That was too much. But for the most part, they're probably not going to be thinking about it. When you don't exercise, when you're not active, you get less sleep, you don't feel like yourself, okay? So this is another piece that's going to come back around to how all the symptoms relate. And then the more time you're out from school, the more anxious you get about academics. You know, I know there's a school in New Hampshire that had to hire full-time faculty in the summer to help the kids who had missed all this time because the rule was automatically that they couldn't do their academic work for 2 weeks or so. And all of a sudden, everything gets logged down. And if you don't have a good plan for making up missed work, you're just going to get these kids all worried about what they're supposed to do. And then the social isolation piece, which I think is huge, and all these things relate to that. So I think for me, the point about rest is it's behavioral management. So if you're going to do less than what you're supposed to do normally, then we have to at least replace the activities and behaviors with other things that might be better so that they don't just play video games at home or so that they don't try to disobey and go shoot hoops when they shouldn't have or something like that. Okay, so getting back to our guiding principles, one of them we're talking about here is we already talked about a brief period of rest is good. And I want to talk about how attending school is good, which is what I was just sort of trying to get at. And I'll show you that, you know, there's a couple of studies that show that it helps. We don't really know what the right load is, which is why we try to go in a stepwise, gradual manner to figure it out. But what we do know is that from some research, attending school after that short period of rest has an actual positive effect on recovery. So the Thomas et al. Study I just went into in depth, and then Majerski from 2008 showed the same thing. And any other studies that pull kids from school don't seem to show an improvement in symptoms. So this won't be for everybody, but this is part of what we're trying to figure out. And I think that going to school has these positive benefits. Another piece that's a guiding principle is how do we make sure that they get back to what they're doing, but we don't push them too far, right? Because sort of maybe I can sort of hear myself as I'm talking about it. I'm sounding like I'm saying that we shouldn't treat this like a serious thing, and that's not what I mean. We do need to make sure that we do the right thing for these kids as they're recovering, but we don't want to go overboard in the wrong direction, coddle them too much, which could end up leading to a negative response ultimately. So how do we do the action and stay below a symptom threshold? I just have a graphic that shows you what I mean by that. It's basically, you want them to try to, segue back into their activities, but to a point where before they get symptoms. So you might start them off on what I call a 20-minute rule. You start doing work for about 20 minutes, and then you stop, and you take a break, no matter what the response is. If you don't have a symptom to that, still take a short 5-minute break and then come back to it. Do another 20 minutes and take a break. Now the next day, you might push it a little bit further, maybe 30 minutes. And if a symptom comes up, that tells you that was what they could handle. And you look at whatever that activity is. Maybe it was that certain type of problem they did. It was math work. It was algebra that caused that. But you want to try to get to a point where they can do their work until they hit a symptom. And if they do hit that, that tells us too much taxation on the brain, let's pull back a little bit. And one way to do that is to pace. And so pacing activities is that piece of working for a bit and then breaking. And it's important to talk to kids, especially the overachiever, to talk them through this, is that they'll actually get more work done if they pace than if they actually just tried to stick it out for an hour and a half of studying. Because I get too many kids that give me that argument, which is, Doc, I'm not going to get my work done to the level I want if I have to take breaks all the time. Yeah, but you're telling me every time you study you're getting these massive headaches, so that's stopping you too from being productive and you're not capturing all the material. So pacing is a good one. And if we're talking about right away, that's just a good rule of thumb for teachers to know, is that you can give them these breaks. Have them walk around, have them leave the classroom, get a drink of water, go to the bathroom, maybe sit off to the side and do a different thing. Don't stay immersed in that same activity for an extended period of time. Do pacing. Gradually increase activity as symptoms improve, right? So I've sort of alluded to that already. And the way that this might work is if you think about when you come back to school, the adjustments that teachers have to make, I think they need to have three components. They have to be immediate. So as soon as the kid comes back to school, there has to be this idea in place where the teacher already thinks, all right, I might have to make some of these adjustments to their routine. I might have to reduce the workload. I might have to not have tests. In our Chalk Talk program, one of the rules is that there is no tests in the first week. There is no long-term assignments. These are things that we are putting a moratorium on for at least a week, and then you only make up what's absolutely critical. But some of those pieces about just general adjustments, and I'll get into some of them more in a minute, they have to happen right away. You can't wait to wait. It's not a wait-and-see approach. Oh, let's see if they're able to do all of it or not. First, we want to put the adjustments in, and the student will quickly show whether they need it or not, because the teacher will observe and be able to understand if they're responding well to the material or not. The other piece is that they have to be flexible and they have to be fluid. And this is another reason why we talk about these adjustments and not the accommodations. Because if we get the whole school involved and everybody's writing up a plan, 504, or getting too serious, or with IEP-related things, it becomes a matter of, well, it says in the document they have to have this. But what if you did that adjustment for a few days and then they didn't need it anymore? I don't know if we really need to put that all in writing when the recovery should happen in a two-week period, but they just need a little adjustment, a little help in that early stage. So it should be fluid. It should be able to come and go. It's there for math. It's not there for English. It's there for English, not there for math. And this is, I think, a tough thing to wrap our heads around, especially for a lot of teachers who are, they want to stay in this, they want to have a rule and a mindset. And what I'm finding is that we've started by trying to give teachers this ultimate structure, just do this or just do that, and I'm finding that that's not what they want at all. They're saying, no, we have to have more of that flexibility, and so that's what we're talking about now, is trying to make it more that you have the ability to go on and off, and we'll look each day to see what's being used and then determine sort of where to go the next day. So you want to make the greater amount of adjustment will be right away, and then as you move forward, it should sort of reduce. And so some questions I think about asking yourself, and you can talk to your teachers about asking, is does the student seem better or worse than they did the day before? Just a general sort of taking a sort of picture of it. And then which adjustments are made And was there more than yesterday or not? Looking at those things, and that's sort of what I just said a moment ago, but that's why we're using an actual measurement in this program where we survey teachers to tell us what was used and what wasn't. This helps us look at it, you know, look at the recovery globally and say, okay, gradually, where are we? Are we on stage orange? Are we moving in to a better place where they can now maybe start to talk about doing some makeup work? That's just reiterating this. And one of the key ideas that I think just works well as a graphic is that when we're first coming back from the injury, it really shouldn't be about output. So a lot of the questions I get is, how do I grade the student if I'm only giving them 50% of the questions? Well, you grade them on 50% of the questions. If they only had five, then you would give them a grade for the five. The focus isn't on that. It shouldn't be on their grade. It has to be on what they're comprehending. Kids are at school to learn. They're not at school to get grades. I understand that you have to give a grade, but so grade them on that modification. If the student came in with a broken wrist and they couldn't write their exam out, but they instead did it orally, you would grade them on that performance, right? And that isn't just an adjustment that was made. So I think we want to think about it in that way and try to teach them about that. So about adjusting and accommodating at school and home. Now, this is just sort of, as I roll through these, and these may be in what you guys have, they're just some of the cognitive domains overarching and then some of the specific ideas for adjusting. And they're going to look like accommodations too, but I think they're just things that teachers can do when we're faced with a child who maybe is showing a symptom that fits the overall category. So if they are struggling with their focus and concentration, you can bring them up. Bring them closer to the action right in front of the room if you have to, or move them away from a place that maybe would make it so it would be harder for the teacher to try to engage them. Checking in regularly to make sure that they're actually gathering the information just makes sense in that early stage. When you have a task that's in front of the classroom and it seems to have multiple steps, or it's a big one, break it down into smaller segments. I mean, this is sort of classic stuff, but it's something to think about when these kids are presenting with these initial symptoms early on. Then you can also give less problems and give breaks. Visual processing, as we've mentioned, can be a very taxing cognitive activity and is highly involved in so many classroom things that we do. So one of the things is a note-taking adjustment. You know, the teacher can provide the student for that week with the notes. Provide them with the notes ahead of time. If something comes up in class, you give them the notes afterwards as well. Don't make that be a demand on them. Shorten up their reading assignments if they show they can do a certain amount. Again, we're back to that idea of measuring where they hit their symptom threshold. Trying to bring the screen time down when possible. Everybody knows about reducing screen time, obviously. And then the oral exam is another good one that maybe that paper and pencil test is just too much of a piece to interact with for them. So deliver to them orally. That can be done after class. And then sometimes it can be helpful if a student is showing real difficulty tracking information on a page to just use a ruler. Just they can hand them a ruler to follow it with better. So learning and memory becomes tough. It's one of these classic things we talk about. Kids with concussion have problems with their memory and their recall. It's harder to figure out. Is it their memory or their recall, or is it really their attention and then their learning? How they're taking the information in may be the actual thing that's being disrupted. So we want to think about ways to bring the information in a more effective way. So teaching, you know, reminding kids about when they read something new, how to identify pieces, like giving them some organizational strategy for when they take something on. Identify the five W's. That's sort of a classic thing from grade school, but it can be helpful in those moments. If they're trying to learn new material using mnemonics, right? This is a picture of Sherlock using a memory palace. You don't have to teach them how to use a memory palace, but the idea of a shortcut to the information. If they have to memorize a list of facts, you know, make an acronym for the front five letters of those facts to try to enhance making a semantic connection with that information. Active reading is another one. If they are faced with a reading assignment, teaching them how to quickly jot down. As they read a sentence, what's the key point? Write it next to it. This cues them to what that is as they move forward, teaching them to ask themselves questions as they read through, seeing that they make sure they follow where they are and they're not losing their focus on it. Planning organization. This is a graphic organizer that can help kids when they're developing writing assignments. Using a planner is a classic one that I think a lot of teenagers probably really hate to use. I know I did. But in that time period when things are still not quite right and it's harder to organize information, it might be a good thing to do. Giving the student a printed out version of their schedule so they don't have to keep it all necessarily in their head if they need to help them remember that, especially if their schedule has been altered, right? So if they're not going to band like they normally would, or if the recommendation is that they don't eat lunch in the lunchroom but they eat it in a different place, helping them remember where that's supposed to be. Do lists, you know, set these short-term goals and make a concrete list so that they know exactly what they're supposed to accomplish and what they're expected to do. And then I talked about using graphic organizers or outlines. And then speed is another huge one. We see it in just pure reaction time, in the fluency of their responding. That also has to do with how they process the information. So a student may need a little bit of extra time. And yes, we're used to all these things as being part of real 504 plans or IEPs, but in that initial few weeks, month, we can give a student a little more time on a test to accommodate this potential weakness. Again, not everyone needs it. It's just that if that's what they're showing, then this would be a way to respond. If maybe there's some anxiety around how they're doing, you might want to test them in a separate room so that they don't feel that even more. As I was saying here, reduce the length, which relates back to if they're not doing things very quickly, we don't want to have them doing homework forever. Try not to, you know, put them on the spot because they might actually be struggling to process that information as quickly as they normally would. Okay. I'm going to talk about just quickly the team-based approach. I only am supposed to have until 10:30. Okay. I was going to stop and say where we have questions, but I think we'll just move forward real quick and we'll get the questions in next. Best practices is team-based approach for sure, but I think a big component of that is education. So education is definitely the best prevention around the best secondary prevention around these injuries. How do we do the right thing after the injury's already happened, right? So primary prevention is going to be very hard for us. These concussions are going to occur, but what do we do to make sure that it doesn't get worse thereafter? Make sure that there's part of professional development is that teachers, nurses, staff, administration, they all get official, you know, formal education about this injury and about how do you help with a return to learn so that it creates a better culture in the school related to this. Having a team approach is really key. Get a team together at your school, and I'm sure most of you guys already have it. And what's probably happening is that you guys are overtaxed, which is that you already had a million obligations, and now you also have to be the concussion team management leader, which is what happens in most places. But this is from that American Academy of Pediatrics piece, which is that you have your home team, your school team, and your medical team. At home, the parents know the student in that environment. They know their child well, and their contributions about what's normal for them versus what's not is very key. Of course, sometimes they may be giving a very skewed view of that because they are very invested in the student seeming better or seeming worse, depending on what they're after. I don't mean to make all parents sound like they're just scheming, but you know, there's so much of it that goes on. At the school, you have your trainer, your guidance counselors, the nurses, of course, which, as I said, are a lot of the times the concussion management team leaders, or at least the leaders of the academic return. And in some cases, as you had your hand raised, that you're also the return to play. You're like the trainer and the nurse all in one. Over 50% of schools in New Hampshire don't have athletic trainers, so that's a necessity. The teachers play a really key role in this, too. And then you have your medical team. You have people like a neuropsychologist who might consult to the school. You have Dr. Carlson, a specialist in concussion management, who might consult to the school, runs a clinic. People come in, and then they write recommendations around that. The primary care provider plays a big role in this as well, and then any other specialists that might come in. Obviously, certain students are going to be working with neurologists or vestibular specialist physical therapists, and their feedback within this, they become part of this team as well. But I guess I'll just step back, which is to say that it's nice to have all these different teams, but what's really important is that they're sort of all on the same field. Like, we have to get them together. A lot of the times, I think there's lacking communication in these groups. The school knows one thing, but the doc from outside says another, and then you're supposed to go through the parent to talk to the doc, or one way or the other. And at the end of the day, the doc's saying they're cleared, but at school they have all these symptoms. How does that make sense? That doesn't make sense. Maybe it does in some way, but somebody needs to explain that. And they need to be, you know, sharing, it's got to be transparent, sharing the information. You see a lot of parents who maybe try to take their athlete to different doctors to get different opinions. That becomes very confusing for the school, puts them in a tough situation. But so we want these to be a communication network, which is another goal of this Concussion Chalk Talk program, is to make sure that everybody sees the information together, so that there's no miscommunication, there's no hiding of information. So this is just meant to show how hard it is to implement this. We can plan it all we want, but still getting it done. It's like writing a law is a lot simpler than enforcing it, right? And I think that's part of this too. And this is just such a multifactorial process. And then it's communication that is the complication. And so Dr. Kim was up here before talking about this very same thing. I wish I'd been here for her whole talk, because the returning cancer population, it makes this seem so much more trivial. But you can learn a lot from that too. And she was saying the same problems, which is that you guys see one thing and parents say another, and nobody's talking to each other in the right way. And what's the mechanism set up for that? And this is where a lot of it breaks down. So we want to improve that as best we can, and that's one of the things that's tough. Okay, so I guess I'm done here, and there's a Q&A. So thanks for bearing with that. I appreciate it. Yes.
You had mentioned when we were talking about the study between the two groups, the one that was a short graph and the long graph,
that
they used objective measures. And I'm curious what those objective measures are, because
sure.
The concussion itself reporting.
Yeah.
Which can be very murky, especially when you're using.
Yeah, so so there were both objective and subjective. Obviously, the symptom reporting was subjective. The objective was neuropsychological testing, where the group, I didn't put this up here because I realized I pulled that slide from an emotional symptoms talk, but they the group that had the stricter rest actually showed longer time to recover back to their neuropsychological baseline, so on skills like processing speed, attention, working memory, visual motor processing, it took them longer to return back to their expected levels than the group who only rested for the short period of time. But it's a great question. We need better objective measure of it, and a lot of it is subjective, but that's where we try to get information from different sources. That study didn't get it from, say, they didn't get teacher reporting plus parent reporting plus something else. Most of the objective I'm talking about here was neuropsychological testing. Yes.
Have you seen the website Get Schooled on Concussions?
I don't.
Karen McAvoy and
Yes. I don't know if I've seen it, but that's the REAP. Yeah, that's Karen McAvoy's the REAP program. Yeah.
For schools to have a better understanding of these kids coming back.
Yeah, I think the REAP's website is really good for helping that. That's Oregon Center for Applied Science also has really great educational materials. I think they are terrific. Nothing replaces, though, actually having like a workshop where teachers and nurses get together and really talk about these things with a specialist, and that's what I think is the most effective. But yes, absolutely, the REAP, R-E-A-P, Karen McAvoy in Colorado, it's a very good website for this. Yes?
I'd just like to comment. In our school, we have quite a few concussions, mm-hmm. Panama High School, and we've had a terrible time trying to manage getting kids back to return to learn.
Yeah.
Part of the problem is that we feel like they can't be put on a traditional 504 plan, but after listening to your lecture, getting teacher feedback and having them really guide the children and measure measurements. They really do need something as firm as a 504 plan. So I'm not sure how we'll change that.
So there are, and I'm sure some people could share this too, some schools sort of have a fast-tracked 504 sort of thing. It's not even a real 504, but it's like a concussion modified plan that they write it all out, and everybody in the school knows about it. Everyone agrees with it, and it is a written document. We've toyed around in our program with having something like that, just a concussion care plan or something that would put it in writing. You could do that if you get your 504 coordinator on board. You guys could write temporary 504s. Like very quickly. I just think that we've tried that in some places, and it's been a lot harder than it sounds. What you're saying is
to get the teacher's attention.
Oh, yeah.
Follow some guidelines.
Yeah.
Real feedback. having a 504 meeting, getting a real... a framework to work with.
Well, I think it becomes a matter of semantics at that point. If you guys decide and commit, you say, we're going to make a concussion management return to learn program at Hanover High School. And these are going to be its components. And it's part of our school policy, part of our return to learn from concussion or general concussion management policy, right? So we do return to play for the physical side, and then we do return to learn in this way, which involves, as soon as the student is identified, there is a meeting, right, with the parent, with a concussion management team leader, with the nurse, and we're going to make a plan. And we're going to email all teachers, and teachers are going to get education at the beginning and say, this is what our school does, right? So like, we're actually, last night, one of my team members went to a new school that we're going to be working with, and we gave a talk to the entire teacher and all the faculty and all the staff, which is saying, here's education on concussion, and by the way, your school is starting to do this program. And this is what your role is. You're expected for this, and we want your feedback on this. And you're going to be asked to fill out this survey on a regular basis. That information is going to be part of this. And every student is going to have these adjustments right away. And then if by X amount of time something doesn't happen, then they'll be referred somewhere else, or there'll be another meeting called. So it's about just setting up a plan and a program. But it has to sort of be, everyone needs to buy in, right? Because then you don't need a 504 plan. Then you just need the school's program being on board. And you need the administration to buy into this and say, yes, this is a really key thing, and we need to have a better approach for it. Because that's what's happening most places. It's a little bit too disorganized, and nobody really knows what they're supposed to do. And there's a lack of communication. And then the teachers feel like they're under-equipped to handle it, or they feel like... why would I do this for this one kid but not this one? And so it's about getting everybody together, and it's really about, and this is going to sound so cheesy, but it's about changing the culture around it, right? We've already worked really hard at getting that return to play culture in line, and I think the media has sufficiently scared parents enough to get them mostly involved and scared schools enough to get them involved, but nobody's scared of return to learn. It's just a mess, right? So, but it's important. So it's just about making a plan and making a program. That's what I think. That's what we're trying to do. Yes?
So how do you address students and parents that are the way overachiever ones?
Yeah.
And, they'll go to, this case, go to the PCP, had a positive Romberg confirmation, this major, concussion without... to me, seeming like the mechanism totally there, but mm-hmm. it was a car accident, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get all the constellation, the feeling, fatigue, and just, are you going to, at what point do you suggest seeing a specialist, and at what point, and for outcomes, if this kid has been out of school for 6 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and... for outcomes, if they're being pushed a little, is that going to affect their outcome if they're cognitively not there, although maybe there might be other
Yeah, there's probably underlying things.
And so at what point, and so the high school's like, okay, the kids can't, she's not doing it in class, and so why doesn't she just go home, apparently. So is there a research that's if they're being pushed a little bit, that's mm-hmm. going to affect their overall?
So the only research I can give you is on... So there's some research that says that, the more cognitively tasking things you do right at the outset, the worse the recovery can be. This sounds way more complicated than this.
Yeah.
This sounds like there's lots of factors going on. There's a car accident. I wonder if there's litigation possibly that's involved or... No, okay. Well, that's always something to think about. If you hear car accident, just remember that. So there's some literature which suggests that doing those cognitive activities at that right away can lead to worse... lead to a prolonged recovery and worse outcomes. We have some preliminary research we did with Dartmouth athletes that shows that if you put them through some light physical exertion activity in the early stages, even when they're still a little symptomatic, it doesn't have a negative outcome on their functioning. They don't recover. It doesn't take them longer to recover than a group that was totally restricted from physical activity. But there isn't a whole great deal for something like that. My thought is, why has this person been out for 6 weeks? Where was it recommended? Why is it that they were told not to be at school at all, even if they had a positive Romberg? They there might have been something going on, but was it such that they really needed to be out completely? So the idea is,
I think for the staff, school, if they're not Where the teacher is like, okay, I don't want to do the wrong thing.
Well, if it's not, it might have been a, I mean, it may also, some injuries are not just mild, they might be moderate injuries. And so you need to see somebody that might be able to pull that out a little bit. And it shouldn't always be the school's responsibility to figure that out.
Point a specialist to say, okay, this
Well, each case is different, but I think that the first step is getting to a PCP right away. And then if that PCP feels like this is something I'm not comfortable with, it doesn't look like it's going to be a regular return after 2 weeks, they should go to a concussion specialist. So if we're in this area, I think what we do is we have a concussion clinic. Dr. Carlson runs that, right? That's if there's a return to sports issue particularly. If not, they if it's a headache specific, it's all about domains. If it's a headache specific, they might go to see a neurologist.
So a good benchmark would be after like 2 weeks.
A lot of people can use, some people use 2 weeks, some people use a month. I mean, I think that if things aren't back, aren't even moving back in the right direction in 2 weeks, you definitely want to have it looked at for sure by somebody else. A lot of it is about educating and talking them through the fact that most of the time this is going to get better if we do the right things. The question is, what happened in those 2 weeks? Were they just restricted from all activity, or were they actually in such a terrible way? Did they have to be hospitalized? Did they need additional medical treatments? I mean, this just—I'm trying to piece out what you're asking from a more general question, and it's tough because it sounds like there was a lot of complicating factors with this particular person, especially if you're not even sure if there was a mechanism of injury. So, what's motivating them to stay out? That's another piece that's always interesting to look at, is what are they gaining from that? If a student is still taking a very long time to recover and they're still reporting symptoms for a long period of time, why might that be? Is it because they're getting a certain amount of attention they liked before? Is it that they never wanted to play sports in the first place and so now they're using this? And it might not be even conscious. It might be an unconscious underlying piece that they're adhering to. Yes?
What would you recommend for the nurse? I had kind of an opposite situation where I had a student who was got injured the night before at home, not in PE, not in sport, comes in to see me, nauseous, headache, bruise on his head, just feels out of it. Sent him home, sent him to the doctor because he hadn't been seen yet. And he comes back 4 hours later to school, returns with a doctor's note that says he has a mild concussion.
Okay.
And nothing else, just the note. You sent the doctor, so he has a mild concussion. So what does the school nurse do with that? Because I would like to send him back home.
Right. Well, so that's what I would do. I would tell them to call home and say, you know, he should probably be home still because this was just last night. If this injury happened, and he should be home for a day or two to try to, you know, reduce some of the activity level, and then he should come back after that time period and see how he does in school. Yeah.
And he's no longer symptomatic, and he feels fine, and he denies any, you know. So is there a reason to put plan in place then if they're not experiencing it?
I think it's a lot of it is about the symptomatic response, right? So I still think you play it pretty safe in a week's time, right? You really want to give it that amount of time where you don't restrict them from everything, especially if they're not showing any symptoms. But since we're basing it all on their report, I mean, if your school was doing neurocognitive testing, for instance, you would have another point of objective data to suggest, well, actually, their cognition seems fine, or their cognition is really struggling and they're reporting no symptoms. So maybe what's going on here? Because they might say they're fine, but they're actually showing that they have a problem in their reaction time or processing speed, and maybe there is something going on.
Well, we have impact testing.
Okay, yeah, so that would be that.
Only for our athletes.
So this is a non-athlete. Okay. Yeah, so that becomes a lot trickier. But I still think you would, in the first week, you'd play it cautious. But if symptoms are not there, then you start to move them back quicker and quicker, right? So if you were even walking through a stepwise progression on this, you would start on the lighter load, and then each day adding more. And if they don't show a symptomatic response, they're probably pretty good to go, you know? We don't want to over-pathologize it, but at the same time, we don't want to totally dismiss it out of turn. So I think a week is not going to mess up the kid's life too much if we just played it cautious for a week.
Health plan, like the fluid plan, that says these are the things you can institute,
right,
but only if they're symptomatic and only if you're seeing
any. Yeah. I mean, I think it's about the symptoms. That's how we treat this anyway, right? And Dr. Carlson will talk about that. You treat it based on the symptomatic response that they're showing you. You play in some guidelines, right? You want parameters to make sure you don't make a mistake, but you also don't want to, you want to look at what's actually right in front of you. What are they presenting with? Let's treat that.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're done? Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, sure.